Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Many thanks for coming along tonight, and many thanks to Clayton Utz for the use of this great facility. And it's great to have Malcolm Turnbull back at the Sydney Institute. He's been here before, of course, but on this occasion as Minister for Communications. As you know, is one of Australia's best known Australians, so I won't introduce him. The member for Wentworth and held senior positions in the Howard government, currently Minister for Communications. And the topic for tonight's talk is Magna Carta and the rule of law in the digital age. Mr. Turnbull, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jared. It's terrific to be here at Clayton Utz. Stuart, thank you very much. I'll echo Jared's thanks to your firm for making this wonderful room available. And thank you all for coming on this wet night. Tonight, I'm going to talk about balancing security and individual liberty. It's a balance our government has, I believe, got right. But in order to ensure that we continue to do so, this conversation is one that should proceed in a considered manner, respectful of the views and experience of others. And to better understand where we should go, we should not forget from whence we came. 800 years ago, England's most despised king affixed his seal to England's most venerated document. As a peace treaty, the Magna Carta failed. King John renounced it within a month. The civil war was resumed, and the rebellious barons effectively renounced it within a year when they offered the throne to the French heir. Most of its 63 chapters are long forgotten. But generations of Britons and their descendants in the new worlds of the Western and Southern Hemispheres drew from it the very distillation of the rule of law. Most important of all is what became Chapter 29 in the 1297 Restatement. No free man is to be taken or imprisoned, or disseised of his free tenement, or of his liberties or free customs, or outlawed or exiled, or in any way ruined, nor will we go against such a man, or send against him, save by lawful judgment of his peers, or by the law of the land. We will sell to no man, we will not deny or defer to any man either justice or right. Now, it was not long before Magna Carta was invoked by philosophers such as John Locke and later the founders of the American Republic to protect the citizen not from the tyranny of kings, the revolution had seen to that, but from the tyranny of the majority. In 1791, the United States Constitution's Fifth Amendment emphatically cemented the supremacy of the rule of law as administered by the courts of justice. No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without the due process of law. Carved in stone in congresses and courthouses, recited in state constitutions, Magna Carta has been even more celebrated in the United States than in the land in which it was written. And by the time our Australian Constitution was being framed, a century or so later, these rights were judged inalienable and inherent among the British people who formed our Commonwealth. In 1925, the Federation Father and by then High Court Judge Sir Isaac Isaacs described these values as the base of the social structure of every British community growing from the Magna Carta, which he described as the groundwork of all our constitutions. Now, Australia is a democracy, now one of the world's oldest. We're often described as a liberal democracy, and by that additional qualification is signified our commitment to the rule of law. Some people imagine that a democracy is simply a society where the majority of the people get to decide who runs the country. But a society where a majority can do whatever it likes is not a democracy, it is a tyranny. The notion that the majority entitles the government it appoints to rule as it pleases is as pernicious a doctrine in our time as the divine right of kings was in the time of King John or Charles I. The genius of a liberal democracy is that at the same time it empowers the majority through the ballot box, it also constrains that majority, or its government, through the rule of law. The rule of law, which applies to the government as much as the governed, is not as widely appreciated around the world as we might think. Historically oppressed majorities in Syria and Iraq have seen the prospect of democracy as offering an opportunity to visit the same or worse persecution on the minority as had been until recently visited on them. A newly empowered majority government in Egypt, the product of the Arab Spring, promptly set out on fresh waves of persecution against minorities, especially the Christian Copts. Democracy, Churchill reminded us in a parliamentary debate in 1944, is no harlot to be picked up in the street by a man with a Tommy gun. One of the most important elements of the rule of law is that citizens cannot be deprived of their life, liberty, or property without due process of law. That requires the decision of a court, arrived at after a fair and impartial hearing of both sides of the argument. That principle is reflected in our Constitution, which provides in Chapter 3 that judicial power, the determination of disputes between citizens and the state, can only be exercised by the courts. Now, there's no question that things change in times of war. Two lines attributed to Cicero are often cited to challenge the primacy of the rule of law in times of war or heightened threats to national security. The first, Salus Populi Suprema Lex, states that the safety of the people is the supreme law. The second, Inter Arma Enim Silent Leges, observes that in the time of war the laws are silent. Put together, many would argue that when the security of the state is under threat, the claims of security will always trump the rule of law. And there's no doubt that historically, basic rights, including habeas corpus, have at times been suspended in times of war to allow indefinite detention. It's been ever thus. Thomas Jefferson observed in 1810 that to lose our country by a scrupulous adherence to written law would be to lose the law itself. On the other hand, Benjamin Franklin had famously written 35 years earlier, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." Here, equally eloquently, is what the founder of the Liberal Party, Robert Menzies, had to say on the same subject in 1942, during the darkest days of World War II. "If the day is to come when the courts are to be closed to the aggrieved citizen, when the king's writ is not to run because popular uproar wills it so, when the appeal to the law is to be an occasion of scoffing, then that day will cast a black shadow across British freedom. The law's greatest benefits are for the minority man, the individual." Now, the balance between security and liberty will always be controversial, and that's a good thing. But we need to recognise that getting the balance right is not easy, not least because it may shift over time. And we're more likely to do so if there is a thoughtful and well-informed public debate, weighing up the reality of the national security threat, the effectiveness of proposed measures, and then asking whether those measures do infringe on our traditional freedoms, and if so, whether the infringement is justifiable. It's important to remember, too, that people and societies with an equal determination to defeat terrorism, the current threat, can have different views on what is the right balance and indeed what the right measures are. Denouncing those who question the effectiveness of new national security measures as friends of terrorists is as stupid as describing those who advocate them as proto-fascists. And this debate is not an easy left-right divide. One of the most consistent and cogent critics of our own government's legislation on many national security topics including data retention and citizenship, recent ones, has been the Institute of Public Affairs. Respect for the rule of law is, I put to you, at the heart of what it means to be a conservative. As part of this doctrine, the rule of law imposes on legislators and judges a conservative caution when making new laws. The idea that in general, new laws, to quote Dyson Hayden, should only be changed by a process of gradual development, not by violent new advances or retreats or revolution or ruptures. This approach, that an old law is a good law, has been very, very influential in the government's approach to the Citizenship Act changes. Instead of proceeding with a proposal which would give the minister the discretion to revoke Australian citizenship if he believed the person affected had engaged in terrorist activities, the proposed amendments build on the existing provisions in sections 34 and 35 of the Act. The upshot of this is that section 35 will be modernised so that it applies to people fighting for a non-state actor like Daesh or ISIL as much as it applies to a person who fights in the army of a country at war with Australia. The rule of law is respected because a person whose citizenship ceases in those circumstances has full recourse to the Australian courts under the Constitution to contest the matter on its merits. Again, to quote Menzies, to ignore the Constitution, to treat its structure and the limitations it imposes upon the powers of the Commonwealth Parliament as of no account, to endeavour by clamour to prevent recourse to the courts for its interpretation is to violate the whole conception of the rule of law. Now, the 9/11 destruction of the World Trade Center towers is often referred to as the beginning of a new age of terror. It was, on any view, the most shocking terrorist attack in our times, and we are still living with the consequences. But as we commemorate the centenary of World War I, we should not forget that the fuse was lit by an act of terrorism, the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand on the 28th of June 1914. Indeed, one of the first acts of terrorism in Australia was on New Year's Day in 1915, when two Turkish sympathisers opened fire on the picnic train from Broken Hill to Singleton, killing six people and wounding another seven. The melancholy truth is that terrorism has always been with us, and no doubt always will be. Terrorism is defined in our law as using or threatening violence or damage to people or property with the aim of coercing the public or a government to advance a political, religious or ideological cause. It's a wide definition, applies to acts in any country and includes interference with infrastructure, including telecommunications and power grids. Our law makes it an offence for Australians to be engaged in terrorist activities anywhere in the world. The policy justification is that we just don't want Australians being involved in conflicts of that kind. Now, while our laws also make it an offence to join or support specific listed terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda or Daesh, terrorism itself is defined very broadly. Importantly, the definition does not form a view as to the merits of the terrorist activities. As far as Australian law is concerned, all terrorist activities are unlawful for Australians to engage in or support. So if our aim is to eradicate terrorism, as opposed to defeating a particular terrorist organisation like Daesh, we are unlikely to be successful. There will always be people and groups who choose to use violence to pursue political goals. Now, just as it's important not to underestimate or be complacent about the national security threat from Daesh, it is equally important not to overestimate that threat. Any threat, of course, looms largest when it is closest to us in either time or space or both. In Menzies' day, our democratic way of life was threatened by two totalitarian ideologies, Soviet communism and fascism. Each were proselytising ideologies. One was defeated in battle in 1945, the other expired, largely from its own contradictions, 25 years ago. China, the last nominally communist superpower, does not seek to export its way of government. But Daesh is not Hitler's Germany, Tojo's Japan, or Stalin's Russia. Its leaders dream that they, like the Arab armies of the 7th and 8th century, will sweep across the Middle East into Europe itself. They predict that before long they will be stabling their horses in the Vatican. Well, Idi Amin wasn't the King of Scotland either. We should be careful not to say or do things which can be seen to add credibility to these delusions. Daesh, more than any of its predecessors, has been able to use the increasingly ubiquitous internet and social media to amplify its significance. As the Prime Minister has observed, a jihadist needs only a victim, a knife and a phone to create an act of terror which will be viewed around the world. Daesh's recruiting formula, often slickly produced, includes the well-known combination of sex and violence, especially the latter. It works for Hollywood, so why wouldn't it work for Daesh, especially when a twisted and archaic interpretation of Islam is used to legitimise it? We need to be very careful we don't get sucked into their strategy and ourselves become amplifiers of their wickedness and significance. Currently, the government believes there are around 120 Australians known to be fighting, mostly with Daesh, in Syria and Iraq, with around 160 in Australia providing them with some form of support. These numbers are larger than on previous occasions Australians have travelled overseas to fight in jihadist causes. Both the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the wars following September 11 resulted in small flows of foreign fighters, including Australians, to the Middle East. And there have been earlier precedents, of course. Numbers of Australians fought in the Balkan Wars in the 1990s and in the Spanish Civil War of the 1930s. The government's policy on foreign fighters in Syria and Iraq is quite clear. We do all we can to stop people travelling to fight there, and many passports have been cancelled to that end. It's an offence to fight for a terrorist organisation and indeed to travel to the key designated areas of the conflict in Syria and Iraq. Now, once somebody has got there, however, and started a fight, we don't want them to come back trained and brutalised, as they are in terrorist practices. And the recent amendments to the Citizenship Act are designed to ensure that dual nationals will lose their Australian citizenship from the time they start fighting with Daesh, thus eliminating any right to return to Australia. Daesh is similar but different to Al-Qaeda, from which it evolved. It appears to place less strategic focus on attacking the West than Al-Qaeda did, as it is seeking to establish a state of its own, its claimed caliphate. It's recruited foreign fighters more rapidly than its predecessors, a consequence of its use of contemporary digital media on the one hand, and what appears to be tangible success on the ground. Now, it's more important that counter-terrorism measures be the right ones, the effective ones, than that they simply be tough. Tough policies can be popular. They may even be justified at the time they are conceived, but they can still be a mistake. I suppose there's nothing tougher than invading a country, overthrowing its government, and occupying its territory. But with the benefit of hindsight, few today contend that the 2003 invasion of Iraq, popular with the US public and Congress at the time, was not a tragic error. The Islamic terrorist seeks to provoke the state to overreact because it creates a more receptive environment for the extremist's recruiting efforts, based as so much of it is on perceptions of resentment, oppression and humiliation. As the then ASIO director David Irvin said last year, we should not let the phenomenon of violent Islamist extremism destroy the community harmony that is such an essential characteristic of Australia's highly successful multicultural democracy. That is precisely what violent extremism and terrorism want us to do. Now, recently, the Prime Minister announced $630 million in counter-terrorism measures, with a particular emphasis on community engagement and engaging with young men and women before they become radicalised. As the Prime Minister said when the package was announced, the best defence against radicalisation is through well-informed and well-equipped families, communities and institutions. As such, local engagement is at the heart of many of these measures. And just last night, President Obama, on precisely the same wavelength as our Prime Minister, reiterated this point where he said success depends, and I quote, on Muslim communities, including scholars and clerics, rejecting warped interpretations of Islam and protecting their sons and daughters from recruitment. A crucial element in countering violent Islamic extremism is authoritative Muslim voices which challenge the extremist's interpretation. A good British example of this, which I commend to you, is www.imamsonline.com, which makes the case against Daesh on the same digital platforms as those on which Daesh campaigns. Now, one final observation is that broadening the focus of our counter-terrorism efforts is to acknowledge that in a liberal democracy, the government cannot direct the media how to do its job, but neither can the media escape its responsibility for the consequences of how it reports violent extremism. On this front, the use of social media by Daesh has been more sophisticated and prevalent than perhaps any other terrorist organisation before it. And organisations like Twitter and Facebook have been forced to reconsider their policies and have become more active in taking down offensive material. In Australia, these companies continue to work with the government and other agencies to ensure their response to the publishing of extremist material is appropriate. More broadly, the media has a powerful role in both fostering a sense of cohesion and countering extremist material. I note the review into the Martin Place siege praised the role of the media in not exacerbating what was already a difficult situation or seeking to inflame the messages Manmonis was trying to spread. But the damage that sensationalist reporting can do is immense. Now, that debate has come into sharp focus following on from the ABC's decision to include Zaki Mallah in a live audience, a gentleman who had been charged with terrorist offences that had been acquitted but had been convicted of threatening to kill ASIO officers. A number of those issues relating to that decision were investigated by the government following the broadcast, and I won't add to the report of that inquiry, which is on the department's website. But as the sentencing judge noted when Mr. Mallah was convicted in 2004, providing such coverage to his views runs the risk of spreading divisive and discriminatory views. The other, and perhaps the most important part of the government's response to Daesh, is of course lending the support of our armed forces to defeating them in the field. The means of doing so are well beyond the scope of this speech, let alone the expertise of the speaker. But the rollback and destruction of Daesh in Syria and Iraq is critical to ending not just their barbaric rule in the Middle East, but their appeal beyond it, even, as we know, regrettably, to a few, more than a few perhaps, of our own citizens. Now, it may seem paradoxical that as we celebrate the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta, it's at a time when laws are being adjusted, often controversially, to enhance national security. But the truth is that in these times, less remarkable than we imagine, we should never forget the value of the principles of Magna Carta. They must live in our hearts as well as on the pages of statutes and constitutions. I hope we will always believe, as a core political value, that no one should be punished without a fair trial, and that a true democracy constrains the majority even as it empowers it. We should always shudder a little, perhaps shudder a lot, when cynics sneer at courts and laws as just troublesome obstacles standing in the way of justice. While we are, and always will be, facing new and evolving threats to our national security, our forebears have faced far greater ones. In 1939, Robert Menzies, Prime Minister, was leading Australia into a war against Adolf Hitler, a foe whose march across Europe must have seemed at the time nearly irresistible. This was an existential threat. And he introduced a national security bill that gave extensive powers to the government to control the economy and much of Australia's daily life in what was to become a total war effort. His warning to the House of Representatives should resonate down the years to all of us, especially those of us in the party he founded. "The greatest tragedy," Mr. Menzies said, "that could overcome a country would be for it to fight a successful war in defence of liberty and to lose its own liberty in the process." Thank you very much.
Why don't you stand there?
Many thanks, Minister, for a very thoughtful presentation. So we come to questions and discussions, and we've got till the no later than the top of the hour, so we probably won't need all that much time, but we have it. Just go back to your final point about the point you made about Robert Menzies in 1939 and the real existential threat. As you know, in the period 39 to 45, say in the first 2 years, 39 to 41, you had the Communist Party, an ally of the Nazi Party, Communist Party people in Australia who Menzies outlawed the Communist Party on the first occasion, or he succeeded on the only occasion at that time. But I guess one of the differences was that whilst the Communist Party was a revolutionary party and wanted to overthrow the government, it was never a threat to individual citizens. I mean, it didn't go around knifing people or shooting people or bombing people or whatever else. So to what extent is that a difference, that Daesh at the moment is a threat to individuals in a way that the Communist Party, whilst it was a threat to the state half a century ago, wasn't a threat to individuals in an ongoing way?
Well, I think that the way Menzies saw the Communist Party was, of course, not as a left-wing Australian political party, as many of us in our political lifetimes would have seen it, but as the arm of aggressively expansionist imperialist Soviet empire that was seeking a global hegemony, and had, of course, by the time you got to the early 1950s, Menzies was quite persuaded, I mean, as indeed were his counterparts in other Western countries, that war with Soviet Russia was very likely. National service was increased, defence expenditure was increased, and then, of course, the Korean War came along with all of its, with the engagement of Communist China. It was you're right, the Communist Party of Australia didn't practice terrorism in the street, as it were, but it was a threat to the West, or perceived to be a threat to the West. I mean, there are revisionist historians now who say they never had, all those tanks didn't work, they didn't really have the means to do it, but I think the perception at the time was certainly that they were a genuinely existential threat. I mean, of course, and there's absolutely no doubt that Hitler's Germany was. That Second World War was, on any view from the Western side of the Western Allies at different times, a closer run thing.
This question right down the back. You just speak up, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Malcolm, we talked a lot about strangling of Daesh from the front end in terms of stopping the supporters and stopping people from going over there. But of course, there's a back end. There's the provision of the logistics, there's the provision of the finances. What is the government's attitude towards nation states like Qatar and Turkey or providing that back end to allow them to continue?
It was a question just in case it wasn't picked up.
Yeah. No, you're asking about sympathetic, what you've said at states like Qatar and Turkey. Well, look, I mean, Tony Abbott, I can't improve on Tony's description of the scene, the politics in the Middle East as being a witch's brew. It is, ultimately the various actors in that region will have to see the recognise the their self-interest in defeating Daesh in the field. That ultimately is the challenge. But they obviously have occupied a vacuum that was left in that part of Iraq by the what appears what was clearly the failure of the of the Iraqi state, and of course the failure of its armed forces, who in many cases chose not to fight, and of course left Daesh their weapons, paid for in large part by the American taxpayer. So it's, which means, of course, that the irony is that Daesh is fighting with newer equipment than the Kurds, who we are much more, you know, who we regard as at least, you know, on the same side.
But is there any political pressure from those countries
who are supporting them to become that? Well, the answer, this is not a, I mean, I can't speak for what pressure or what discussions Julie is having with those, with, you know, the foreign minister of Turkey, but obviously every effort from the, you can, I think, safely assume that every effort from the countries that are seeking to suppress Daesh is being extended to ensure that its support is cut off, whether it's support from foreign fighters or financial support or military support.
Question here.
Thank you very much for the speech. We all believe in liberty, but will millions of dollars of government money be used to give legal aid to those terrorists who want to appeal against the loss of their passports?
Well, the I mean, legal aid is a legal aid is you know, available on its you know, that doesn't seek to judge the merits of the particular case, you know. So I'm not sure what the arrangements are for people taking administrative proceedings to object to the removal of a passport, but it is you know, I mean, the one, I think it was one English judge who said the courts of justice are open to all, just like the doors of the Ritz Hotel. And that's why it is, you know, legal aid is a very important part of our legal system. Otherwise, it would mean people with little or no means would have no access to it at all.
Stuart Clark.
Malcolm, thank you very much for what was a very thoughtful address, and I think you struck the balance between the very real threat and the need to preserve the rule of law very well, so congratulations. A question in terms of the current iteration of the law. It's currently proposed only to deal with those who have dual nationality, yeah, and not to address those who have sole Australian nationality. There are restrictions on, by virtue of international covenants on Australia rendering people stateless. How would the government propose to deal with a person who currently has dual nationality, goes to join Daesh, finds him or herself falling foul of this law, but renounces their second citizenship, such that the only citizenship they have as a matter of law is Australian, and then seek to return to Australia? Is the government prepared to take a view with people, or in relation to people, who choose to put themselves into a stateless state as a consequence of the legislation?
Well, it's a good question, Stuart, and I think the answer, it's hard to answer that in a theoretical sense, other than to say that you're dead right. We are a party to a number of conventions which require us or oblige us not to make somebody stateless. So there is a consideration of an option in the discussion paper that's currently the subject of the consultation being overseen by Philip Ruddock and Senator Ferravanti-Wells, of dealing with a situation where a person is a sole Australian citizen but has a legal right, perhaps by birth or by you know, by perhaps because their father or mother was a citizen of this other country, has a legal right to become a citizen of that other country. Look, there are very big legal issues surrounding that, but the government's policy, as clearly set out in the bill that is before the Parliament at the moment, is not to render anyone stateless. So, for example, to give you an example, if you had someone who was a dual Australian and UK citizen and was fighting in Syria, and the British used their powers, and they have very sweeping powers. They, of course, do not have a written constitution. They've got the Magna Carta, but they don't have a written constitution with an express separation of powers like Chapter 3 of our constitution. And say the British were to revoke the citizenship of this individual, the British citizenship, then it wouldn't be open to us to, under our current arrangements, to regard that person, that Australian, by now sole Australian citizens, citizenship to be revoked. But of course, you know, I mean, if they did come back to Australia, they would could expect a very lengthy term of incarceration. So, you know, I imagine that many of these people will not seek to return home, given that would be their almost certain destiny.
Thanks, Malcolm. That was a really good talk this evening. I just had a question about the $630 million that are being spent on the anti-terrorist efforts. There was a story yesterday in the Herald saying that only $1 million of that is being given to local Australian Muslim groups. Should we not be spending more to do some positive PR around the Muslim community, and should we not be using more digital means such as social media to reach people before they're radicalised?
There is over $20 million of that money which is being focused on using digital platforms to counter violent extremism. But you know, all I would say is that this is a very rapidly evolving situation. You know, the internet, the ability of people to be, the capacity of people to be radicalised online, you know, in the privacy of their own bedroom, you know, young people being radicalised in this way, and there have been, you know, been quite more than a few cases of this, not just here but in other countries, emphasises that we need to be more effective online. But of course, you know, the government is not going to be as persuasive as persuasive Islamic, as credible Islamic voices. I mean, let me go back to the point I made in the talk. What Daesh is a sophisticated user of social media, and you know, and YouTube, or the videos get taken down from YouTube pretty quickly, but online video, they are very sophisticated users of those mediums, and they do publish and promote this extraordinarily brutal violence because it assists them in recruiting. I mean, it's, you know, it is appalling. It is the quintessence of evil, but it does attract some people. It attracts enough people for them to find it useful. A key part, and this is where it's important not to be mealy-mouthed about it. I mean, sometimes people talk about, you know, a war on terror or a war on terrorism. I mean, what we're really talking about here is a tendency within Islam of violent extremism. You know, we're not talking about, that is the current problem, the current issue. And a key part of that is the legitimization that is given by a twisted and archaic or perverted interpretation of Islam. In other words, they're being told by people who claim to have authority that this is God's will. This is the right thing to do from a Islamic point of view. And so the counter case against that is going to be put most compellingly not by, you know, the people at ACMA or the Department of Communications or the people at the Attorney General's Department. It's going to be put by equal authoritative, credible, persuasive leaders in the Islamic community who can say no, as the imams do on Imams Online that I mentioned in the speech. No, that's dead wrong. That is absolutely wrong. What you're being told is rubbish for the following reasons. And that's a very important part of it. Now, the extent to which Western governments should be supporting that and how they should support it is a matter of very keen debate. If you look at the latest edition of Foreign Affairs, there's a good article there by Ayan Hirsi Ali, who I'm sure many of you have met or heard speak, who is a woman who was a refugee from Somalia, went to the Netherlands, Muslim woman, went to the Netherlands, became a member of parliament, took on the extremist tendencies in the Islamic community there and paid quite a heavy price for it, and has been, she would say that she is a campaigner for a Muslim reformation, I think would be the way she's presents herself, and she's written a very good book on this topic as well. So she makes the case that the Western government should support those moderate voices, those reforming voices, in the same way as the American government supported anti-communist voices in the cultural domain during the Cold War, you know, such as Quadrant magazine in Australia, or Encounter magazine in the UK, and you know, there's quite a few. There's another piece following hers which makes the case that that would be quite counterproductive, because it would, you know, it would in effect delegitimise the alternative view. But that's why it's important to have these discussions, and why it's important for the situation to be constantly under review, because it is quickly evolving, and people need to get a clearer picture of it as we become more familiar with it. I mean, a lot of these phenomena, Daesh itself, but social media itself, are relatively recent. I mean, Facebook didn't exist in 2004. You know, Facebook is tech. Facebook, a platform with well over a billion accounts, with most Australians having an account on Facebook. I think it's close to 60% of Australians have a Facebook account. It's been in existence for 10 years. So we're only really just starting to understand the reach and the force of these social media platforms and all of their various, you know, lookalikes and counterparts.
Question here. Malcolm, you made a comment earlier about media responsibility. My question relates to the incidents of 2013 where first Nicola Roxon, in the tightening of the offence provisions of the Anti-Discrimination Act, assumed people to be guilty and having to prove their innocence. And then shortly after, there was the ASADA fiasco, where sportsmen were assumed to be guilty and then had to prove their innocence. This is a complete reversal of the what we hold dear, that presumption of innocence. Do you believe that the media were very asleep at the wheel, not doing anything about that?
Well, look, I don't want to get into the details of that particular case, because it's a while ago, and your recollection of it's probably keener than mine. But I think there is often a pell-mell rush to judgment, isn't there? And we've got to be. I think it's very important that we be always seen to be measured and responsible in our approach to any of these issues. You know, that is why. I mean, it's very interesting. I'll just share with you another piece of Menzies, because I've been going back, as you can see, I've been looking at Menzies, A, because he's, you know, one unquestionably he's not our greatest living Prime Minister, that of course is John Howard, but he's certainly, John would concede he's the greatest, by any test. But it's very interesting, in that debate in the House of Representatives in September, on the 7th of September 1939, and, you know, maybe there's a few of us that were alive at that time, but I don't think there's any of us that would remember it very keenly. You can imagine the sense in the chamber. You know, all of those people, all of those members had many of them, perhaps most of them, had fought in the First World War. There would have been a ghastly feeling of, here we go again. Hitler had been just winning again and again and again, obviously, with Czechoslovakia. Now, he did seem irresistible. Indeed, that's why there was an appeasement movement in the UK that basically wanted to do a deal with him and get out of the war. So, you know, these were dark, dark, dark days. And it's interesting, Menzies went to great pains to note that this bill, which did give enormous regulation-making power to the government, and it was modelled on similar legislation which had been enacted in the First World War, he noted that it did not allow the government to introduce conscription by regulation, nor to subject any person not in the military to the jurisdiction of courts-martial. And this is what Menzies said. There is, and I think properly so, a very great objection in Australia to submitting to this method of trial by court-martial persons who are not subject to military law. There is a very great objection to the notion of a civilian being subject to a form of trial which is other than the usual form of a trial to which a civilian may appeal. Now, that, just the clear, thoughtful, measured lawyer's sanity of that, at that very bleak time, I find very, very inspiring.
In Martin Place was treated pretty sympathetically or softly by our courts, and it seemed to me that siege at Martin Place would not have taken place if he hadn't been allowed out in bail, and any sensible Australian would not have allowed that man with the charges holding against him out on bail.
I think you are not Robinson Crusoe on that. That's a matter that we'll no doubt hear more of as the inquest proceeds. But certainly, you're right. I mean, what can I say other than to say I think the point you make is a very, very reasonable one.
Next question over there.
Yes, you've been sort of talking about, I think, very nicely about how in Australia we've got the issue of the rule of law and the balance with individual liberty, but I just wonder if you could perhaps comment on the extent to which, in fact, individual liberties are actually enshrined in actual laws, in our actual constitution, as opposed to the extent to which our liberties are guaranteed by really convention and perhaps the exercise of common sense by our Australian institutions. And with regard to that, do you imagine that there might be some place in the future or in the present for something akin to a Bill of Rights in Australia?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. Thank you for that. Nearly 300 years ago, when Voltaire had to skip out of France because of a duelling incident, as I recall, and went to live in England for a few years. He was very interested in the English system of government and so forth, and he wrote a lot about it. But I think it would be fair to say that you could sum up his attitude to the English that their freedoms were not based in the constitution, in any written constitutions, but in the constitution of Englishmen. English, he should have said English men and women, but it wasn't a very rather sexist era, I suppose. And I think our liberties and the best protection of our liberties is clearly in the common sense and the values of Australians. And I hope I made that point in this speech. We don't have a Bill of Rights in the American sense in our Constitution. Having a an unsurpassed expertise in how hard the Constitution is to change, let me tell you, trying to introduce a Bill of Rights, I would think, would be impossible completely. The Constitution is practically impossible to change as it stands, but for something controversial, it's not going to happen. The argument against it, of course, is that, and this is always, this is the tussle that all the lawyers here are very familiar with, is that it gives, in effect, legislative power to the courts. If you have a generally worded guarantee of human rights, no Congress shall deprive no citizen of the equal protection of the law, sounds good, yep, but what does it mean? There's a whole lot of these things you'll find in Bills of Rights are good, they all sound perfectly sensible, then what do they mean in a particular situation? And so you end up giving a court extensive legislative power to deal with it. And that's always the argument against it. So I don't foresee there being a guarantee of a Bill of Rights in the Constitution. But of course we have many statutes which provide human rights protections, protections against discrimination and so forth. But they can of course be amended by Parliament, they can be amended by Parliament. They are creations of Parliament. They're not above Parliament like the Constitution is.
We're getting close to the end. We're going to 1, 2, 3.
Minister, there's both political and a legal side to all of this.
Mm-hmm.
As the questioner pointed out a minute ago, the courts were the ones that let Momus out on bail.
Yeah.
So we can't rely on the courts. And when this kind of debate, even when Menzies in 39 was putting that legislation through, the political problem is that out in the community, people are not of the same opinion. And right now we heard today that in terms of single citizenship only, there's a huge majority of Australians that are in favour of having people with single citizenship, including Greens voters, stripped of their citizenship. Mm. So the government has a problem. How do you manage your way through a time when national security is under threat, when people, to some extent, are ahead of the notion of rights and may well, in a kind of acclaimed way, mob way, want something that you would see as being a denial of rights?
Well,
how does the government manage this? How difficult is it?
Well, this is the point that Menzies made in 1942, we have to remember that the rule of law is designed, protects everybody, including the unpopular. You know, including the appallingly unpopular, including the most despised. It protects the minorities, and sometimes people in powerful positions, sneer a bit at that. I had a client many years ago called Kerry Packer who thought he was a pretty powerful guy, and he was brought to the brink of ruin by a Royal Commission that ran off the rails, an agency of the government, to the very brink of ruin. And he was denied due process, he was denied natural justice, he was denied his rights. He had the resources, obviously, to be able to take it on, but it was a very close-run thing. The courts have made a mistake. The courts make mistakes all the time. I don't know whether we want to have robot courts who might be infallible, but as long as they're staffed by humans, they will make mistakes. But, from time to time, ministers make mistakes. It's been known that parliaments make mistakes. We say the electorate never makes a mistake, but that's really a courtesy because because it's quite obvious that from time to time, there's sometimes when a particularly appalling government has been elected or a particularly appalling decision's been taken, a few months after the election, you struggle to find anyone who voted for them. I mean, have you ever met a New Zealander that voted for MMP? I am yet to find one, but it was because of their system of proportional representation, which they all complain about, but it was carried in a referendum. I've never been able to find someone who admits to having voted for it, but clearly a lot of people did.
Robin.
Thank you very much. You've talked about citizenship and the concept in the context of Magna Carta, etc. Does it strike you as in some way extraordinary that there's quite rightly been this debate about when citizenship may be removed from terrorists, which the great majority, it seems, of the Australian public appropriately support, and yet there's been no discussion at all of the fact that the Parliament that sometimes gets things wrong, in 1948 enacted legislation which resulted, without much thought, in citizenship being stripped from a very large number of decent Australians who had done nothing more wrong than applying for the citizenship of another country in which they happen to be living or because they happen to be married to someone in another country.
Yeah, well, that's a fair point. And the dual citizenship is a relatively recent phenomenon. I mean, many countries until relatively recently regarded it as being a contradiction in terms to have two citizenships, because you couldn't have two allegiances. So if you're a citizen of one country and you took out citizenship of another, that would be regarded as a renunciation of your first citizenship. The provision that has been is being modernised in the bill that is before the House and that Peter Dutton introduced in the last sitting. The provision that's being modernised is Section 35, and what it's actually from the 1948 Act. And what it says that if an Australian citizen who is a national of another country, so I guess a dual citizen, fights for the defence forces of a country at war with Australia, then his Australian citizenship comes to an end from the time he fights that foreign army. So it's not a question of ministerial discretion. It's in effect a condition subsequent on. I mean, lawyers attacking it or criticising it would put it in different construction. But I think the way it should be seen is as a condition subsequent on your Australian citizenship, and that you have you've made a choice. Now, what the bill is seeking to do is really to modernise that to include non-state actors like Daesh, and it is a modernisation of an old law. And as I've said, and as the Prime Minister has said, and I've said again tonight, in some respects, many respects, an old law is a good law, because it's been there, it stood the test of time, and you're seen to be amending your laws in the way Dyson Hayden describes, not in a revolutionary way, but in an evolutionary way. And that's, that is very much the common law tradition.
Final brief question. How would you explain the government's metadata policies with respect to the kind of principles you've announced tonight?
Well, that's very... I was really, really pleased you've asked that, Jared. I am, seriously. The metadata... Or the metadata... The metadata is a term that everyone uses, but people have different views of what they're talking about. Let me tell you what we are talking about. From time immemorial, telephone companies have kept what are called call charge records, and these were kept for the purpose of billing. All of us can remember getting telephone bills which showed, my number calls your number, we spoke for 10 minutes... Now, I was in Sydney, you're in Melbourne, and there's a charge. And all of that's call charge records. And that is basically what we're talking about when we talk about metadata. In addition to that, in the IP world, in the world of internet or connectivity, there is what's called your customer IP address. When you have a device connected to the internet, and I can find out what my IP address is at the moment, your device is allocated a unique number by your internet service provider, by your telco, and it is dynamically allocated. Now, Stuart here at Clayton Utes has got a great big server and a big, fat pipe into the internet, no doubt. And he would have a permanent IP address or series of IP addresses for the Clayton Utes sites and all of their online capacity. But the rest of us are allocated an IP address from time to time. And the telcos, again, have kept a record of that because it's important. They've needed it for billing. And all of these records were accessible to law enforcement agencies and had been forever. What was happening was that as the whole of the telco world moved onto IP platforms, it was no longer necessary, theoretically at least, for those records to be retained. And there was a risk that whole swathes of them would cease to exist. So what the data retention law did was simply preserve the status quo in respect of call charge records and that type of IP information so that it should be retained for 2 years. So it wasn't a, it was a, it doesn't seek, there's no obligation, the government has no interest in people's web browsing activities being retained, even though, depending on some technical considerations, telcos could, if they wanted to, keep a record of all the websites you visit. If they wanted to do that, they don't. But the government has got no interest in that. So it was written up as a very radical move, but in fact it was a very it was really no more than a conservative approach to retaining the classes of data that had been retained for a long time, but there was a concern that they would cease to be retained.
Many thanks.
Okay, thank you very much.
And many thanks to Malcolm Turnbull for a very thoughtful speech, and we've taken, I think, over half an hour of questions and discussion, so it's been a very informative evening. I think the last time the Minister spoke to the Sydney Institute as a Cabinet Minister, it was on water, and he managed to bring in aqueducts. It was a very memorable address, as I recall. On this occasion, talking about the rule of law in the digital age, Magna Carta. So we've had a wide historical flow as well. So it's been a terrific night. We're very grateful for you giving such an important paper to the Sydney Institute. You can see from the audience here how interested everyone has been. We're very grateful. We'll hope to have you back sometime in the future. But for tonight, well done and thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.